Welcome to Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This week on Making Contact.
We think that it's absolutely critical that government at some, you know, at some juncture stand up for itself and say, you know, we are here to protect the public.
The time has come for all of us to abandon the fixation on government as an agency of reform, as a repository of the common good. What is left as the helping functions shrink is the military and the criminal justice system, and they do not deserve our support or defense.
As corporate interests continue to erode democracy in the United States, lavishing Democrats and Republicans alike with campaign contributions and plush private sector jobs, independent political parties are organizing to restructure government and the electoral system. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact. In January 1993, the Reagan-Bush era ended. Bill Clinton became the first Democratic president in 12 years, and his party had a firm hold on Congress with over 60 newly elected representatives. According to Dan Hamburg, a freshman Democrat that year from California's 1st Congressional District, there was an air of optimism in the House among progressive forces. They hoped to pass a health care bill, revitalize education, and protect social services. But, says Hamburg, the Democratic leadership in the House and the system of legislative rules made it impossible to pass such reforms. That's one of the reasons Hamburg abandoned the Democratic Party and joined the Green Party.
There are committee chairs, there are rules committees, there are structures in place that severely limit what even can come up onto the floor of the House for a vote. So, you know, you can start off with some very, very exciting and innovative ideas. And as a member of the Progressive Caucus, we worked out ideas that we thought were very much worth legislating, ideas to try to put people back to work, for example, and try to rebuild the infrastructure of the country and try to improve the deteriorating schools of the country and many things like that, that we could not even get through a committee or through a rules and then through a rules committee and then to the floor for a vote. So it is hierarchical. If you stay in the House long enough to get into one of those positions of power, it's likely that the institutional culture has pretty much captured you, which does not mean that you become a bad person. But what it means is that you are unwilling to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And when I use that expression, I use it mindfully because that's exactly the expression that Congressman Vic Fazio used to always use with me when I would argue for going for a stronger piece of legislation instead of always compromising back to the lowest common denominator. I think you really have to move outside that system so you can look at it in an objective manner and realize, firstly, that it is only a system. It's only a construct. And as a construct, it can be reconstructed. And that's what I think we need to do with the institutions of government. And Congress is a good example. I mean, when Congress has had 435 representatives in the House for almost 100 years. So that means that a representative who used to have, say, you know, 30 or 40,000 constituents now has 600,000 constituents. Now, you know, that might be an argument for looking at expanding the size of the legislature, but let's be even more expansive than that. Let's look at the way that we have set up political institutions in this country, including the electoral system, and see if it is a system that more stultifies or more imbues the political process with new possibility. And I think it's the former and needs to be the latter. And, of course, that's why the Green Party is taking such a strong and definite stand on the issue of electoral reform, because we feel like there is a stranglehold of the Democrats and Republicans in a whole host of ways that keep new light, new energy, new ideas from coming into this political system. And as most of your listeners know, our political system is basically a reflection of the economic system. It's basically in the service of an economic system, because we have things turned around. Instead of having the economy be a tool for creating a better society, instead the society has become a tool of the economy for creating more private profit.
In the last 20 years, we have had an extraordinary concentration of power and wealth in fewer and fewer global corporation hands. And you can see the consequences of that in so many ways.
Ralph Nader, founder of the consumer watch organization Public Citizen, speaking in Los Angeles after accepting the Green Party nomination for president in 1996.
When you have that kind of concentration of power and wealth, you have a weakened democracy. You have a weakened public voice. You have a weakened public advocacy. And that registers. And look how it's registered. Look at the signs of decline in this country, because our democracy has not been allowed to strengthen itself, because we don't spend enough time as public citizens, because we have allowed global corporations with no allegiance to our country scour the globe for the dictatorships and the dirt cheap labor to exploit and export the jobs there. We have allowed them to take over our government, to dominate our economy, to exploit small business, to straitjacket inventors, to shape our very culture, to replace our folk culture with commercial culture that stresses violence and addiction, to decide what kind of research is done at our universities, to decide that the ordinary people pay the taxes. As someone once said, only the little people pay taxes. To decide that they, the corporations, weren't going to pay any taxes. And now look at the result. In the 1950s, corporate income tax represented between 25 and 30% of the federal outlays. Today, it's between 6 and 8%. Record corporate profits, record stock market prices, record executive compensations, and they are paying a shrinking amount. And many of these giant corporations pay 1% federal tax, 2% federal tax. For all those super rich Pollyannas who think America is number one, look what they and their corporate cohorts have done to America to make it far less than number one. In 1980, the U.S. was first in wages in the world. It's now 11th and sinking. In 1980, the U.S. was the greatest creditor in the world. It's now the biggest debtor in the world. Today, we're 17th in the world in infant mortality. We have 23% child poverty. Think about that. Almost one out of every four children in America live in dire poverty, with all that means in terms of stunted human potential, health hazards, safety hazards, brutalization, and surroundings that you wouldn't want to have to describe with any equanimity. You know what the child poverty rate is in the Netherlands and Sweden? 3% in Netherlands, 2% Sweden. We're the only country industrialized in the world that doesn't have universal health insurance. Over 40 million Americans, many of them children, have no health insurance. 20 million are underinsured, and the rest wonder when they're going to fall through the cracks when they change jobs, pre-existing conditions, co-payments, deductibles, exclusions, cancellations. Hey, this is the land of the free, home of the brave. What gives?
Independent candidates often face an uphill battle when it comes to mounting local, statewide, or national campaigns. Election rules and the cash-generating potential of established political parties favor Democrats and Republicans. One of the biggest hurdles independent candidates face, according to former Congressman Hamburg, who's running for governor of California this year on the Green Party ticket, is the requirement of winning a majority of the vote in a given district or state. Many other countries use what's known as a proportional representation voting system. Dan Hamburg.
the major thing that holds back the Greens from being able to really put forth their message is that they're existing in a milieu where virtually all of the, you know, in winner-take-all elections, the winner in any particular assembly district, Senate district, congressional district is going to be one person. If the Democrat gets the plurality, they're going to go in. If the Republican gets the plurality, they're going to go in. Because of that system, there is no way for third parties to get representatives into legislatures on the state or the federal level. We are one of only three industrialized democracies in the world that do not have multi-member districts, that do not have proportional representation, that do not allow for methods of voting so that minority parties have an opportunity not only to get onto city councils, which are nonpartisan races, by the way, or supervisors' positions, which are also nonpartisan, but also to be elected to a legislative seat or to an executive seat such as I'm running for. Because it's a winner-take-all system and because it's a straight, you go into the polls, you vote for one person, your person either wins or loses, because that's the system that's in place, I think it discourages people from voting for the candidate that they really want to see win because of that whole issue of, well, you're just throwing away your vote, you're just being a spoiler. And, of course, it's not being a spoiler to try to expand democracy by giving people more choice in the voting booth.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program can be heard on over 130 stations in the United States, Canada, Haiti, and South Africa, and around the world on Radio for Peace International Shortwave. If you want free background information on the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736.
While some political parties are advocating reform, others are calling for more radical solutions. Barbara Ehrenreich, writer and co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, said last year during a Socialist Scholars Conference in New York that she no longer believes the U.S. government can be an instrument for positive social change. She termed her talk Confessions of an Ex-Statist.
It is no longer possible, I think, to stake our hopes, even short-term hopes, on government. And I say this, first of all, in the most practical sense in this country. No one, or not many people in this country, wants to hear about more government or bigger government or, in many cases, even better government. Government, and especially federal government, which has been the most progressive element of all of our governments, has been discredited as a potential agency of positive change. Maybe not discredited forever, but discredited for now. We are not going to get anywhere with a left program consisting of brilliant new government initiatives. We're certainly not going to get anywhere with the idea of socialism, if that can be understood by our fellow citizens as being more and more of the same government we now have. Now, there are two reasons for the discrediting of government in this country. I'll divide them into dumb reasons and not so dumb reasons. The dumbest reason, of course, is that the political right and the corporate community have spent the last 15 years denouncing and deriding the U.S. government. Who would have ever guessed the United States would solve its enemy shortage, finally, by picking on the government of its own, this country? Anyway, this decade and a half of right-wing anti-government rhetoric has had its effect. And this effect has been magnified by the fact that government does very little for most of us in our individual lives. Little, I say, compared still to most European social welfare states. Most of us do not get any help with our health care expenditures, with college tuition, with buying a home. And should we face unemployment, well, that safety net is no longer there. Most of the ways most of us in this room probably encounter government is in the form of small-minded and overbearing bureaucracies, such as the IRS and the Department of Motor Vehicles. As a result, there's a vicious cycle at work in our society. The less government does for us, the easier it is to believe the right-wing anti-government propaganda. The more we believe it, the less likely we are to vote for a government that might actually improve our lives. Now, usually on the left, we look at this vicious cycle and we say, well, this is crazy. This is false consciousness. The right wing has been running down the government. People should be angry at the corporations. And of course, they should. But there are some good reasons, and now we come to the not-so-dumb reasons, to be profoundly distrustful of the U.S. government. First, it's unspeakably corrupt. I mean, do I have to say any more about this? We know what everything costs in Washington now, how much to have coffee with the president, how much to sleep over at his house, the price of further intimacies we could probably find out, too. Secondly, this government is a government that provides less and less protection from corporate abuse and profiteering and from the market economy in general for anyone. While the helping functions of government have steadily declined, the intrusive and the repressive functions have steadily grown. And again, thanks in no small part to Bill Clinton, whom even Anthony Lewis, good liberal of the New York Times, has called the president with the worst civil liberties record ever. He signed an anti-terrorism bill expanding government wiretapping and other forms of surveillance while curbing habeas corpus. His White House commission, this may sound like a small thing, but I don't think it is, on airline safety is recommending expanded searches of passengers. Everybody will now be profiled for suspicious travel patterns. But of course, the most clearly repressive feature of our government is its vast and growing penal system, which by the year 2010 will contain a majority of our nation's non-white men over the age of 18. And for what crimes are 5 million Americans incarcerated? Well, 75% of them are in prison for committing a crime arbitrarily and fancifully created by the government itself, the crime of drug possession or sales. Now, this massive... We in the United States, as a result of these things, face a government very different from that of Spain or Sweden or Portugal or even France. We have the highest percentage of our population incarcerated of any industrialized country in the world. And I should mention in the same breath, we are the military fortress of the world, spending 5 times as much on the military as any other country. So this is not a nanny state here. It is a huge and heavily armed cop that we have. Government has not been shrinking. Only the helping functions of government have been shrinking. The repressive and the parts involving violence are growing and growing. Now, this does not mean we can't try to reform government. And I have great respect for those people who try, and I participate in these efforts to democratize it, to get campaign finance reform, to create third parties, to preserve our fragile civil liberties. But until these efforts begin to bear fruit, it's very difficult to see government any longer as a repository for our hopes for a just and caring society. At some point, I think, the ratio of the repressive functions of government to the helping functions gets so big that you have to conclude that this is not something we can use. It has become our enemy. And I think with the war on drugs, with the failure of Clinton to come up with national health insurance, with the destruction most recently of welfare, that we may have passed that point. And I think the time has come for all of us to abandon the fixation on government as an agency of reform, as a repository of the common good. What is left as the helping functions shrink is the military and the criminal justice system. And they do not deserve our support or defense. In fact, when the emergency breaks out that welfare reform is bringing about, 12 million poor women forced out into the low-wage end of the workforce without, in most cases, any child care or health insurance, we won't be able to turn to government then. Government already washed its hands of these people. We will need some old-fashioned non-government responses. One of them is union organizing, and organizing workfare people, welfare people, all of them. the creation of cooperatives, the creation of kinds of institutions that we have not seen in this country really in any strength in 100 years. And we will still have to stand ready to oppose the government's program of locking up more and more of the poor and minorities, especially as they become more desperately poor. Well, if we set ourselves, you may be thinking, in opposition to the U.S. government, doesn't that put us in the same wacko company as the far right? Yeah, I suppose so. I've thought about this in some ways. On some issues, yes, and that should create some very interesting dialogues with some of my people in Montana, for example. But more importantly, I think, opposition to unjust government puts us back squarely in the left-wing tradition. We've been liberals for too long. We've taken the place of liberals for too long. I was a liberal when I defended those programs that the liberals had stopped defending themselves. When I talk about that left-wing tradition, I will end also by quoting Marx. Maybe he's coming back in style, huh? Marx did not say government is a wonderful instrument of social change. Go out and lobby and elect some reform candidates. Try to make it work for you. He said, under capitalism, government is the executive committee of the bourgeoisie. Our job is not to defend it, not to try to expand it, but in a democratic and nonviolent fashion to overthrow it. Thank you.
Writer Barbara Ehrenreich. Meanwhile, public interest groups are fighting to preserve some of the last vestiges of government oversight by mobilizing at the grassroots level and taking on corporations with lawsuits and direct action. Former Congressman Hamburg is executive director of Voice of the Environment, a political action group that is challenging the transfer of public assets to private interests.
This transfer is happening at an alarming rate, and we point to examples all over the state of California and all over the country, but the one we're most focused on currently is the issue of Headwaters Forest and also the issue of salvage logging. And we are trying to stop the destruction of the last of the old-growth forests of California and the United States. And we're trying to do that by offering a systemic explanation of why this transfer of assets from the public to private hands is taking place.
Maybe you can continue with the one example you brought up, which is the Headwaters Forest, namely how the CEO of the Maxam Corporation, which owns Pacific Lumber, the primary logging company in the Headwaters Forest, how Charles Hurwitz, a multimillionaire of the ilk of Ivan Boesky and Mike Milken, and how is it that he, potentially convicted a criminal, at least a financier who's under intense scrutiny by the federal government, can benefit from the government?
Well, I'll put a couple names out at the beginning. Vernon Jordan. Most of your listeners have probably heard of Vernon Jordan. Another person they may have heard of is Tommy Boggs, whose father was Hale Boggs Jr., who was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the House for decades. Tommy's sister is Cokie Roberts, who is an anchor person on NPR. So we're talking about very powerful people in Washington who are hired by Mr. Hurwitz so that he can have his way with federal officials. And it is because of that kind of system and how that system functions in Washington that Charles Hurwitz is able to be on the verge of being handed $380 million for a tiny fraction of Headwaters Forest. My organization, Voice of the Environment, and I just want to mention that the person I work with, Lewis Seiler, was the founder of the organization, and he is kind of leading our effort in this regard. We have determined that at this point in time, what is most needed is an appraisal of the property, an appraisal done by non-interested citizens, done neither by the government nor by Pacific Lumber, that will demonstrate to the public that they are getting hoodwinked and they are paying way more for this forest than any value based on the existing environmental restrictions on that land. Those concessions are basically gifts of the public, of the public trust. They are forest lands. They are mining rights. They are all the things that are really owned by the American public, and they're being given away to corporations like Maxam because the government basically is marching to the tune of the Vernon Jordans and the Tommy Boggses and the people who are their clients.
With the help of the Cokie Roberts.
With Cokie Roberts out there to pitch in on the radio.
I'd like to go back to your point about appraising the land up in Headwaters as an example for a clearly process that you're hoping to initiate, which is to shed light on some of these multi-million, sometimes multi-billion dollar deals where big corporations benefit from the government's actions. Let me make a cynical statement and have you reply. I mean, certainly the savings and loan debacle, which took place in the 80s, was certainly appraised in many a headline. And billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' dollars went to bail out sometimes people worth billions of dollars, including Charles Hurwitz. And little really has resulted from that. And I'm wondering what you hope to gain by shedding light on some of these aspects of private interest benefiting from public interest.
Well, specifically in the case of Hurwitz, it's the intention of Voice of the Environment, our president, Lewis Seiler, and myself as executive director, to stop this deal from going through. Our next demand, and you know we've put it on the table already, our next demand is that the Clinton administration step up to the plate and take on the issue of regulatory takings. Because if a government cannot pass laws to protect the public trust against profiteers like Charles Hurwitz and private property and profit-based corporations in general, then we have no government. And if governments have no power to regulate, then really, you know, that means they basically have no power to pass laws, they have no power to enforce laws, they have no power to demand that there be human standards along with economic standards. So we think that it's absolutely critical that government at some juncture stand up for itself and say, you know, we are here to protect the public. We're trying to defend the idea that there is a concept of the public trust and that concept needs to be defended.
Dan Hamburg, a voice of the environment. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at independent politics and public trust. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Roger Leisner of Radio Free Maine and David Barsamian for recorded portions. I'm Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, or if you'd like to make a comment or suggestion for future programs. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production funded by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. Our producers are David Barsamian, Philip Babbage, and Denise Grob. Our senior advisor is Norman Solomon, and our executive director is Peggy Law. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For everyone at Making Contact, thanks for listening.